Support for WPR comes from 4imprint, providers of promotional products for businesses, including embroidered apparel, trade show items, and logoed business gifts. More is at 4imprint.com. 4imprint, for certain. Support for WPR comes from the American Society of Landscape Architects Wisconsin chapter, dedicated to reimagining the design of outdoor spaces for the well-being of all. Examples at wiasla.com.
It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps. This hour, Global Noir. We're going noir this hour with a show on crime fiction. If your taste in reading runs to blood spatter and bullet holes, there's a whole new world out there, because the latest wave in crime fiction is global. Writers from Europe, Asia, Africa, and Latin America are reinventing the old-fashioned detective story. One of the first to put this new wave on the map is England's Barry Forshaw. As editor of the website Crime Time, he covered the Nordic noir movement, and lately he's been talking up Euro-noir. Barry, it has been kind of exciting to see how international crime fiction has become in the past few years. What's happening?
Well, it actually always has been international. It's just that we didn't notice it. Certainly in this country, we read Georges Simenon, and we thought the writer just has the misfortune to be born in Belgium. He's really British. But then everything began to change, really, with Henning Mankell and Stieg Larsson, when the Scandinavian wave started to break over our heads.
But beyond Nordic noir, there's an entire European continent of crime fiction waiting to be discovered by American and British readers. I know you've been surveying this for a new book on Eurocrime. Give us a sense of, you know, the international range.
Well, I think it's interesting that when I was writing Euro Noir, I looked at the countries which had a kind of the sense that something was really happening, something big. For a long time, it was Italy. And you had writers like Camilleri. His Montalbano series is made into a very popular TV series over here. Then you had France, which has a particularly healthy selection of writers at the moment. There's a woman writer called Fred Vargas, whose books are eccentric. They seem in some ways like Agatha Christie-type mysteries, but with something wrong, there's a screw loose, there's something missing. And they have a tremendous sense of France and the French sensibility.
Now, what about if we head over to Germany? Who are the big stars there?
There's a writer called Nele Neuhaus, who is phenomenally popular. Snow White Must Die is the kind of breakthrough novel. It's about a young man coming back to his country town, and he's been convicted of a crime which he may or may not have committed. And this crime has had terrible repercussions on his family. The problem we've got when I'm talking to you like this now is that you can only say so much about them because you don't want to give any revelations.
You can't give it away. So every writer is different, of course, but are there general national characteristics that distinguish, you know, German crime fiction from, say, French crime fiction?
Yes, I think there is with French crime fiction, there's a certain playfulness, there's a certain Gallic whimsy, which you will find in a lot of the French crime writers. In the Italians, and this is quite interesting for the British, we love to look at the series adapted from the books, and we like to read the books, which all have this Italianate warmth, and everything is slightly laid back. But we in Britain don't quite respond to that. We think that's not really the real world. The reason we like the Scandinavians is because it's a cold climate, just like Britain. They have a fairly phlegmatic, not so much gloomy, but what we would consider to be a realistic view of the world. And we feel that that's the real thing.
The detectives in Nordic fiction, you know, they're usually on the grim side. They're all these introverted, depressed, alcoholic, divorced detectives.
Yes.
Are the Mediterranean detectives a generally happier
bunch?
No,
you see, now that's quite interesting. The Mediterraneans, like Montalbano, have good sex lives. They eat a lot of excellent food. They're always sitting in one of their favorite restaurants where the maitre d' always knows their name and knows what they like. And behind them is the ocean. But we know it's not real. And we do want damaged coppers nowadays.
Why do you think that is? Why do we want our heroes troubled?
Because perhaps vicariously we want and don't want the kind of life they have. We love to be the detective who solves everything. We'd like to think we are that capable. Also, you have to say that it is often in crime films, it used to be, the policemen were rather dull just solving the cases. So now one way to make the policeman interesting is to give him just as much character and just as many problems as any of the criminals have.
Hmm. You know, reading crime fiction, one of the great things about reading crime fiction is that it can be a way to get a kind of inside view of the social or political issues in another country. So what kind of issues do you see, for instance, German crime writers writing about?
Well, in the terms of the German crime writers, as yet, it's just really what could be applicable to America and Britain, which is the corruption beneath the surface of an ordered town, quite often small towns, in which everything seems to function okay and everybody is happy and they get on. Needless to say, this conceals some heinous crime that was committed, usually far in the past. Crime fiction of many of the foreign countries is about something from the past coming back to affect the present.
Do you think that has to do with the sort of echoes from World War II or Germany's Nazi past?
That is, in fact, not so much the Germans, although they do talk about it, but as the Scandinavians. So Joe Nesbø, his books are about the legacy of the wartime past and the slightly tricky relationship that some of the occupied countries have. Joe, for instance, talks about the fact that his own father fought on the side of the Germans in Norway and was obliged to apologize for this. So this is, it's still a hot potato for many of the Scandinavian countries.
But this reminds me of something I think you wrote about. Somebody said to you, one of the great reasons to read crime fiction is if you're traveling to another country, read a crime novel from that country. It will tell you much more about the country than a travel guide would.
It's absolutely true. Invariably, a crime writer is trying to make his or her country interesting. And things have changed. So, for instance, Ian Rankin, who sets his books in Edinburgh, when he first started to talk about Edinburgh as a city of murder and violence, he said that the local council was not really happy with him. This was not the image they wanted presenting of Edinburgh. However, of course, now his character Rebus, there are Rebus tours all over Scotland and Edinburgh. That he is, and as there is with Stieg Larsson, there are Lisbeth Salander tours. We don't really believe that any of these countries are as corrupt as they are in the crime fiction. But nevertheless, these things are built in. Those kind of emphases, those little nuances about a country, you're more likely to find in crime fiction than you are in literary fiction or in just a tourist guide.
Barry Forshaw is the editor of the crime fiction website Crime Time and the author of Nordic Noir and its sequel, Euro Noir. If there's one show that's put international crime fiction on the map recently, it's The Killing, the Danish TV show that's been a huge hit in Great Britain, where literally millions of viewers watch it in Danish with subtitles. It's so popular, fans have even begun dressing like the show's detective, Sarah Lund, in her trademark Nordic sweater. An American remake of The Killing aired on AMC, but there's nothing like the original for Brittleton. Steve Paulson tracked down screenwriter and producer Søren Sveistrup.
Søren, for Brittleton, or The Killing, has been described as the best crime series in the world. But for an American audience that hasn't yet caught the show, can you fill us in on what we're missing?
Actually, the idea of for Brittleton was pretty simple and banal. At the time, I was pretty provoked by all the other shows. I'm a big crime fan, of course, but crime show fan. But many shows, they depict crime as and murder as a kind of industry. You know, one episode, one serial killer, and the killer is caught, and then we move on to next episodes. And I got bored with that, so I wanted to show that you could do actually a lot of drama with just one murder, one killing.
So what you're interested in is not just trying to solve the murder, but the fallout from the killing, including the fallout for the family, for the parents
of the
girl who's been killed.
Yes, I wanted to show the and focus on the human consequences, actually. So I wanted to see if I could depict the world's strongest family, actually, the world's strongest family, and then to see them try to survive this terrible crime.
Thomas!
we did a lot of research on the on actual killings in Denmark and abroad, and unfortunately, of course, the relatives, the families, they have a lot of fights and struggles afterwards. Their lives change very, very abruptly, and their destinies are totally different from before the incident.
God aften, det er fra Kriminalpolitiet. Jeg hedder Sara Lund. Jeg skulle egentlig tale med deres nabo, Gertsen. Ved de, hvor hun er?
Can you describe your central detective, Sara Lund? How is she different from other detectives who've come before her?
I don't know if she's different, but she's definitely has become an icon of great interest. She's not especially a female detective. Actually, she's more thought of as a kind of alien from outer space, you know. She fell to Earth, and now she has to deal with humans. And she's socially handicapped, you could say. I mean, she doesn't really listen when people are talking to her. She can't really relate in many respects to socially.
Well, and the other thing that I'm struck by is how you depict Sara Lund, just visually. I mean, she doesn't wear sexy clothes as many American detectives would wear. In fact, she has this trademark sweater that she always wears, and I understand that it's become a phenomenon.
Yes,
her sweater.
No, because, you know, at the time when we started out, every show had this female detective in high heels, and while she was solving the cases, actually, she was also dating the forensic guy, you know, and I thought, this can't be done. So, of course, Sophie Grubbel is amazingly attractive, so maybe that's why we can do it. I mean, you can lock her in a box, you can turn out the light, and there will still be a special glow, you know, around her and the box, and so it was easy to dress her down. I mean, we really dressed her down, and then Sophie had a good idea. She said, "Okay, if I'm that much my own person, my own character, maybe I could walk like a man." So she tried it to, you know, instead of walking female like females.
And, what does it mean to walk like a man?
No, you know, you can walk. It means like a farmer, maybe, or like John Wayne. I mean, a good old cowboy.
I think I've just discovered the secret of your TV show. You've created a modern John Wayne, but as a woman in Copenhagen.
or Clint Eastwood. I mean, I'm a great fan of Clint Eastwood. So we talked a lot about Clint Eastwood and also about spaghetti westerns, because we wanted to have, you know, that whole feeling in an urban way, you could say.
Jeg hører, at bilen hører under Troels Hartmanns kontor.
Ja, de har lejet den. Indtil videre, det er vores vigtigste spor, ja.
Hey, elsker.
Hej, Bengt. Undskyld.
No, I'm struck by some of the things that you've said that you wanted to do, to dig into with your television show, The Killing. I mean, talk about, explore family, love, vengeance, grief.
Yes.
I mean, these are the subjects of great literature, of course. And I guess I'm wondering if there are certain advantages of playing this out in the crime genre.
Actually, when I think about how we started out, I wanted to do something more novel-like. I just, you know, realized that if you take TV seriously, I think it has a lot of resemblance to a novel, actually. It's not like this was actually easy to do in Denmark, because a lot of people, they said, how can the audience deal with a crime story that actually goes on in so many episodes? But today, you know, people are saying, okay, that was good. I mean, we needed that. We were tired of, you know, all the one episode stuff too. So I think it's okay in some respects to compare the opportunities of a television show to a novel.
No, I have to ask you about Danish television in general, because it's really hot right now. I mean, around the world, and not just your show, The Killing, but The Bridge, Borgen, the upcoming 1864. I mean, these are catching on fire around Europe and starting to catch on in the United States. So what's going on with Danish TV? Why is it so hot?
Well, Denmark and Norway, Sweden, we haven't been on the map, so to speak, that much. So there's a special feeling about these territories now. And of course, we are a bit strange compared to many other countries, because we have this welfare system. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, maybe that social awareness has been also a gift for many writers and directors. And I think that's you get a different flavor in the international market, and I think we need that. I mean, in a few years, maybe it will be, I don't know, Colombia or Bolivia, you know, that kind of flavor. You never know.
Yeah. And one thing that's striking about not only your show, but a lot of these other Danish TV shows is there seems to be a great deal of interest in border crossings. I mean, even your show, The Killing, it takes us into Norway in season 3. Mm-hmm. What's going on here, do you think? Well, why this fascination with crossing borders?
It has to do with the everybody thinking global. I mean, I'm thinking global, but then again, we are very, very, you know, we feel very strongly for our local situation, for our places, so residences. And that is very much the case in Denmark because of the weather, I think. I mean, if you've seen the Killing, you would understand why, because it's always rainy. And in fact, we only have, you know, maybe 1 month a year, and it's November. And every month is November, actually. But of course, also even the Danes wants to cross borders. And but normally we stay indoors, you know, in our IKEA homes. I think, you know, that's why we love IKEA that much, because of the weather. We have to stay inside. But, you know, sometimes, and even Saarlund has the courage to cross borders. And, you know, you always love that when characters, they have the courage to do that.
Steve Paulson talked with Søren Sveistrup, the screenwriter and producer of the Danish TV series For Brittleson. The American remake is called The Killing, but hold out for the original. We're talking about having the courage to cross borders as readers in this hour. Crime fiction from India, Israel, Spain, and Africa when we come back. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Writers around the world are using the noir formula to tackle important social issues. In India, Kishwar Desai takes on gender inequality and violence against women in a crime novel called Witness the Night. Her detective, Simran Singh, is a social worker sent into a small town in northern India to help a young girl accused of killing her entire family. Here's an excerpt.
I thought I'd never do this again, but when I read about this case, it intrigued me. Because it was in my hometown, Jalandhar, I had a very good idea what it was like to grow up as a small-town girl, and I thought I could understand Durga better than most people. I thought I could perhaps help her cope with her distress. Could she really have killed 13 people in one night? All of them had been poisoned, some were slashed with a knife, and few were half-heartedly burnt. As my mind sifts through the various possibilities, I know that Durga's case fascinates me. The name itself is so apt. Durga, the fiery, many-armed goddess whose capacity for blood and mayhem is pure mythological theater. However, the Durga I've come to examine in Jalandhar's overcrowded jail seemed terribly insecure and rather vacuous, and so young. Now, lying in bed in the stuffy guest house early in the morning, I can still hear her voice, muffled by grief and perhaps an inability to grasp the cards that life has dealt her. For the first time in my life, I doubt my ability to deal with the situation. Does she remind me of myself at 14, confused and depressed? Could I ever have killed another person? I stub out my cigarette and try to sleep. The important thing is to remember to organize some liquor if I'm going to stay on here. I should have brought some in my suitcase from Delhi.
An excerpt from Indian writer Kishwar Desai's debut crime novel, Witness the Night. And now let's head to Israel to meet the man behind one of the few detective stories written in Hebrew.
He stared at his computer screen, waiting for the right moment. "Do you know why there are no detective novels in Hebrew?" he then asked. "What?" Why aren't there any detective novels? Why doesn't Israel produce books like those of Agatha Christie or The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo? I don't read much, she replied.
Avi Avraham is the detective in a new series from Israeli novelist D.A. Mishani. The second volume, called A Possibility of Violence, is just out in English. Jim Fleming talked with him back when the series debuted. And in addition to writing crime novels, Mishani teaches literature at Tel Aviv University. So Jim wanted to know if it's really true that there's no detective fiction in Israel.
It's partly true. Hebrew literature is, in general, is very young. It started only something like 150 years ago. The project of Hebrew literature was always very ideological and connected to the project of reviving the Jewish nation. And so literature, Hebrew literature, was always very serious. So writing in genres, not just crime, but also science fiction, for example, hardly existed.
I understand the need to revive the Hebrew language. You'd think, then, that one of the ways to encourage people to read Hebrew would be to publish literature that people would really want to read. And, I mean, frankly, serious literature is not always the first choice.
Exactly. And this is fascinating because the people who tried to promote crime fiction, they said, listen, this is what people will read. Let's translate Arthur Conan Doyle and let just the children read Sherlock Holmes so they'll learn Hebrew and not run away to read Sherlock Holmes in Yiddish under the table.
Well, I understand that, and it makes some sense to me. At the same time, Sherlock Holmes stories are not, I think, kids' stories.
Exactly. This is, you know, I remember one of the first experiences I have as a reader is reading at, I think, 8 years old, The Hound of the Baskervilles. And I remember I was terrified.
Yeah?
And I clearly remember reading all of the Holmes' stories available. And then from Holmes, I switched immediately to Agatha Christie. And I remember clearly one of, again, an important moment in my own private history as a reader, the moment where I finished the last Agatha Christie novel that we had in our library. And I remember not knowing, so what am I going to read now? I just want to read, you know, more stories with this detective character. It doesn't matter if it's Holmes or Poirot or even Miss Marple, but I want this detective character. So this was really clearly like a moment where I stopped reading detectives for quite a few years because, you know, there weren't many.
I think it's time to be introduced to your detective, Avi Avraham. Who is he? What is he like?
Okay, he's in the beginning of the series, in the first novel, The Missing File. He's 30 years old. He works for the Holon Police Department. Holon is a suburb of Tel Aviv, a middle-class or low-middle-class urban suburb of Tel Aviv. He's considered to be a good officer, but he's not very high-ranked. And the case that he gets starts as a minor case, in a way. It's a, you know, disappearance of a 16-year-old boy.
You've laid the foundation for this, I think, by giving him a partial story that isn't obvious at the beginning about his hobby. Would you set up this reading for us? He's talking
He's talking to Marianka. She's a Belgian police officer that he meets in Belgium, where he goes for like a week of police training. What do you do when you're not a policeman? She asked, and he said, I'm a policeman then too. It made her laugh. Even on weekends, don't you have any hobbies, like karate, perhaps? Actually, I do have a secret hobby that very few know about. I like to read crime novels when I have the time and watch crime movies and television series and prove the detectives wrong. She didn't understand. No one understood. Prove to whom? Myself. With every crime novel I read, I conduct my own investigation and prove that the detective in the book is mistaken or else deliberately misleads the readers and that the true solution is not the one he presents.
What is he talking about? You're saying that Agatha Christie and other detective novelists mislead us?
Yes. You mentioned that I'm teaching a course on the history of detective fiction. And when I did that, I discovered while reading again and again the same crime stories and the same crime novels, I discovered that every crime story and every crime novel had a different solution to them. And the true solution was like hidden from the readers and was written, if you want, behind the detectives' backs or something.
So did you take that to heart as you began to write The Missing File? Did you want to make Avi's solution to this mystery subject to doubt?
Yes, and in fact, I think something like that happened to me in a way. I wrote the novel, and when I wrote it, I had the solution in mind. And then when I finished the novel, I couldn't take the solution. I told myself, listen, you can't have this, as this is not the right solution. There must be another solution. And I didn't know what to do. In fact, it took me weeks, and I was, you know, the novel was practically finished, and I sat every day in front of the computer waiting for another solution to appear, and it did appear. In fact, the novel has, I would say, two solutions, one that I premeditated and planned, and one that one of the characters, in fact, Marianka, this Belgian police officer, she brought the new solution to me. I was completely taken by surprise, and I think this is the true solution, but maybe there is another solution that I don't see in the novel.
You know, the unsatisfactory part of that from a reader's point of view is that part of the pleasure of reading mysteries is to get to the end and have it fixed, unlike the real world.
I know. I think that this is crucial. The fact that the end, you know, the solution is not completely clear, because I think that it leaves the reader with, you know, with questions, not just questions about who did it, but what really happened there. These are the questions that I think the reader should, you know, remain with after finishing a crime novel.
You're very enthusiastic about crime as literature. What do you think it brings to literature?
I'll tell you, you know, I want to be particular about that and tell you what it brings to Israeli literature. For example, Israeli literature was written mainly about Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, and the kibbutzim, the classic central symbolic spaces of Israeli culture. What was neglected there by Israeli literature is the suburbs. And so, for example, my novel that takes place in Holon, the suburb of Tel Aviv, is probably one of the first novels in Hebrew literature to take place in Holon. Holon is a very big city in Israeli terms, not much smaller than Tel Aviv, but it never interested anybody in literature because, you know, it doesn't have any symbolic importance. You know, it's not very religious and it's not very secular. It's not part of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. So this attention to spaces and people and social problems, crime fiction can look at. And I think it was the case in the States too. I mean, if you think about noir fiction and what writers like Chandler and Hammett did in the 30s, taking literature, bringing it into the streets, this is something that, you know, crime fiction does, for example.
This is the literature of real life.
Yeah.
Jim Fleming talked with Israeli crime novelist D.A. Mishani. The second in his Avi Avraham series is just out in English. It's called A Possibility of Violence. And now, a crime story that begins literally across borders in a plane, traveling from this country to Kenya.
A beautiful young blonde was dead, and the suspect was an African male. I was traveling to Africa in search of his past. What I found there would either condemn or save him. As you can imagine, my business was urgent. How many times had I thought of Africa? Not many, I'm afraid. Yes, I knew of Africa. After all, it was the land of my ancestors, a place I vaguely longed for without really wanting to belong to it. I might as well say it here. Coming from the U.S., there was a part of me that had come to believe Africa was a land of wars, hunger, disease, and dirt, even as my black skin pulled me towards it. So how many times had I thought of Africa? Not many, not in a real way.
Mukoma Wangugi is one of a new generation of transnational African writers. Born in the U.S. but raised in Kenya, his novels deal with the politics of race and class across international borders. His books include Nairobi Heat and Black Star in Nairobi. Steve Paulson tracked him down.
Mukoma, the opening pages of your first novel, Nairobi Heat, are set in Africa, but the plot, the crime, actually starts in Madison, Wisconsin. Do you consider this a Kenyan novel, or is it a transnational novel, or do these distinctions even matter?
I tend to think of it more personally. I think of it as my novel. But definitely, I would say it fits in a trend of transnational African literature. You know, there is a group of us who are born in African countries and then lived in the U.S., or in my case, vice versa. I was born in the U.S., but lived in Kenya for half my life before coming back. So there are ways in which really my imagination draws freely from Kenya and also the U.S.
Well, your central character in these detective stories is this detective named Ishmael. And he's always a bit of an outsider, an African-American man who's never been to Africa, who's probably never thought about it that much, but then suddenly finds himself dealing with this very different culture.
Yeah, the question of Africans and African-Americans, because of my own, you know, the way I grew up in both places, has been very central to my imagination. I had some black American friends in the early 90s who went to Kenya as part of the study abroad program. They were hoping Kenya to be welcoming, you know, because of the shared blackness, you know, and a shared history of in this case, of slavery and colonialism. But when they got there, people started calling them Mzungu. You know, a Mzungu is a term, it's a Kiswahili name for a white person. You know, and they ended up being so distraught that they left Kenya early.
What you're doing in these crime novels is so fascinating because you're dealing with complicated political worlds, social dynamics, racial dynamics. You could have done this in a different kind of literary novel. I guess I'm wondering why this genre of crime fiction?
Oh, because you can do so much with it. You know, I like to think of it as having endless possibilities. For example, in Black Star Nairobi, and also Nairobi Heat, actually, you know, I've seen critics call them very, very violent. I think with this sort of a genre, I can be as graphically violent as the story needs, actually be as graphically violent as reality. And I think with realist fiction, there's always, even though you might be writing about genocide, I think there's something that's supposed to be pleasant,
right?
You know, about realist fiction.
Well, and then to make things even more interesting, we should mention your father, who's a very famous Kenyan writer, Ngugi Wa-Thiong'o, who is very well known for his advocacy of work written in indigenous African languages. And here you are writing in English in the noir, typically American hardboiled style. I mean, sort of you couldn't get further away from what your father writes. It's rather interesting, I have to say.
In terms of language, I agree a lot with this position, you know, especially for people like me who can speak Kikuyu and can write in Kikuyu, which Kikuyu is my language, is my first language. I do think as writers we have a duty to our languages. And we have been answering that question for myself slowly and over time. You know, but for him also, he does understand the politics of trying to publish in African languages. So for him, he says, well, if you have a novel to write, don't say you won't write it until you can write it in an African language. Write the novel. It's better the novel is there, you know, than it's not.
Yeah. So what happens to Ishmael when he goes to Africa then, when he goes to Kenya? I mean, what does he have to struggle with?
Well, now, when he goes to Kenya, he finds that the sense of justice is not what he's used to in the U.S., though he does suspect in the U.S. he has an illusion of that justice is always served. But anyway, he gets there and he finds that the violence is unmitigated by anything, you know. So within a few hours of landing, he's in a shootout, him and his counterpart, the Kenyan counterpart by the name of O.
Is it clear that O and Ishmael are always the good guys, that they're always on the side of justice, or does that line get blurred?
Well, it's constantly blurred, you know, because essentially what people like O are doing are what now Amnesty International would call extrajudicial killings, right? A few years ago, the Kenyan police were accused by the Kenya National Human Rights Commission of taking out poor young men from the slums like Mathare and taking them out to the forest and shooting them. And for the cops who are doing that, their logic was, you know, these guys are probably thieves, you know, or will be thieves, you know, it's some sort of preemptive justice. So that's the kind of logic that O has. And, you know, I ended up modeling O after detectives who are assigned to protect my father. As you mentioned, he's a writer. At some point, he was in political exile. And then when he went back, he was attacked. Now, the people who attacked him were put on trial. But for us to attend that trial, we had to be under police protection. So we ended up spending a lot of time, you know, with these Kenyan detectives. And through that, I was able to start understanding their duality.
Hmm. Now, what one of the conventions of the crime novel genre is that the central character, the cop, brings order into a world of disorder, of, you know, gives justice where there is none. Are you trying to bring order into your worlds?
No, I mean, they can't, you know. I mean, you know, with Blackstone Nairobi, I actually ended the novel with a question of why, as a way of trying to show that these characters have undertaken this journey. And yes, you know, a few things are better, you know, because they saved the day. But really, essentially all their work, and they understand it as such, is essentially a raindrop in an ocean, right? Essentially, they're swimming against the current of disorder.
Well, I'd love to end with one more passage from your second novel, Black Star Nairobi. And by this time, Ishmael has moved to Africa, and he sort of set up shop there, working in partnership with O. Could you read a passage as he's reflecting on what it's like to now be living in Africa?
Yeah, sure. I hadn't felt American for a long time. In fact, I had not wanted to. A black man from the U.S., I like getting lost in the sea of blackness in Kenya rather than standing out in a sea of whiteness in Madison, Wisconsin. But the idea that a fellow American, a black man like me, could be shot and his body left in the middle of Gong Forest to be devoured by hyenas stirred up an anger in me that I knew was dangerous. In the U.S., we died in all sorts of ways, but never like this. The body in Gong, it reminded me of English 101 Antigone. The king leaves a rebel's body to be devoured by wild beasts. It didn't end well for everyone involved. I just knew there was no coming back from this one, whatever it was.
Steve Paulson talked with the novelist, poet, activist, and scholar Mukoma Wangugi. His crime novels are Nairobi Heat and Black Star Nairobi. And that's it for our conversation about international crime fiction. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk about a new project that brings people from opposite sides of the political aisle together to find common ground. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. And now, bookmarks, writers on books they love.
Hi, I'm Gary Steingart, author of the memoir Little Failure and the novel Super Sad True Love Story, Absurdistan and the Russian Debutante's Handbook. The book that I love, that has stayed on my bookshelves since I discovered it about a decade ago, is a book called Jernigan, J-E-R-N-I-G-A-N, by the writer David Gates. There's a little bit of back history here. David Gates was one of my professors when I was getting a degree in writing at Hunter College. So on a personal level, I've always loved him. But Jernigan is a book set suburban place that we think we know from the stories of Cheever, and that may remind you a little bit of Revolutionary Road, but it's really something so amazingly rendered, set, I believe, in the late 80s. A suburban man meets a suburban woman. It's a love story in a sense, but everything goes completely awry. And it's also the story of children and parents not understanding one another. I think it's possibly the best rendition of the American suburbs that's ever been done. And it was nominated for the Pulitzer Prize. And he followed it up with a novel called Preston Falls that is set partly in upstate New York. If Jernigan is the most hilarious evocation of the suburban ennui, Ben, this is the most hilarious treatment of second homeowners, people who live in a major city like New York but have a home in the countryside several hours away from the city and who try so desperately to get into the ways and the folkways and byways of the local community but who will always stick out as a sore thumb. Both books are incredibly funny. They cover territory that you think you've seen before, you know, the angry white man, but they do it in ways that are so surprising, so genuine, so full of empathy and sorrow that they really put the capital T in tragic comic. There's a scene from Jernigan where Jernigan, the protagonist, is going out with this woman who subscribes to a survivalist ethos. They live in a, you know, in a suburban cul-de-sac, and he doesn't quite fully understand, this is before the term locavore came around, he doesn't quite understand what goes on, the depth to which he lives the survivalist lifestyle, until he walks downstairs and sees cages and cages full of bunnies. And he's given a gun, and he realizes he has to shoot one of them. It's not for the vegan at heart, this scene, but it's so satirically, obscenely, absolutely heartbreaking. Not just for the rabbit that dies, but for the very idea of survivalism in suburbia. These are books that I think should be much more widely read than they are. To me, those two novels, Jernigan and Preston Falls, are always going to be on my bookshelf.
Gary Stangart recommends Jernigan and Preston Falls by David Gates. You'll find more bookmarks on our website at ttbook.org. And now it's time for On Our Minds. This week, the news is full of intractable conflicts and bitter political divides. When isn't it? But there is a project that's giving us a sense of hope. Living Room Conversations brings together small groups of people with opposing political beliefs to find common ground through conversation. It was started by Joan Blades, the co-founder of MoveOn.org. Educator and activist Parker Palmer is also involved. His book, Healing the Heart of Democracy, is just out in paper. So how do you get people on opposite sides of gun control or abortion to come together?
The living room conversation is two friends, each invite two friends, so it's six people, for a very structured conversation. And then the first hour, we're learning about each other to the point where by the end of that hour, we're listening to each other in a very different way when we get to the issue area we're talking about. And you've, you know, shared some kind of snacks, because breaking bread together, being in someone's home, creates a context in which you are comfortable. And then we can listen to each other in a really different way. And the first conversation is really very much about listening. It's not about changing people's minds, though it's about opening them.
Well, give me a sense of what it is you actually do. For instance, I read a story that nearly a year ago in January, you held a living room conversation with a well-known Tea Party activist, Mark Meckler. You pretty much couldn't get two political organizations that are further apart than Move On and the Tea Party. So how did it go, sitting down and having a conversation?
Beautifully. Mark is a delightful guy, and his friends are also wonderful people. And we have really different viewpoints, and that's the reason we need to sit down and find our common ground. We decided to talk about crony capitalism, and I discovered all sorts of things in that conversation. And we discovered we had very significant common ground around the area of criminal justice reform. Everybody thinks there's far too many people in prison and that we need to use evidence-based programs to make things work better. And I was just blown away in the particular conversation you're talking about by all the things that it seemed like we could make huge steps forward if we worked together.
Well, I want to point out how extraordinary this is, though. You're saying that Move On and the Tea Party potentially have some ideas in common, perhaps even some legislation they would both support?
Absolutely. And, you know, when you say Move On and the Tea Party, Mark and I did it as he's a co-founder of the Tea Party. I'm a co-founder of Move On. Mm-hmm. And we as individuals have a great deal in common in this area. And the fact is, in a lot of the areas where we don't have things in common, we don't have common facts. So because of the way our media and politics have evolved, we're listening to separate narratives. If I Google Iraq and he Googles Iraq, we're going to get very different media popping up for us that will tell us a different story. It's really very dangerous for our democracy to have this kind of bifurcated realities.
So we're increasingly kind of living in different political worlds. Now, Parker, this is something you've also addressed with your Circles of Trust project. You're sitting here nodding your head. What are you thinking about what Joan's been saying so far?
I'm struck by a couple of things. One is that I think Joan is right on when she says, let's not think about the Tea Party and MoveOn.org as organizations. Let's think about two individuals getting down to the personal narrative, the personal relationship, the personal conversation. One of the things that I've been saying as I've been going around the country is that in a democracy, it's a lot more important to be in right relationship than it is to be right. And, you know, you can think into that for quite a while, because if we're in right relationship, that means we're creating containers for the kinds of conversations that democracy needs. I'd like to throw in a piece of American history that I think is very important. Joan and I have talked about this. At the Constitutional Convention of 1787, 30% of the folks involved walked out, refusing to sign the document, saying a pox on all your houses. And when I first read that, I thought, that's really interesting, because 30% is about the same percentage of people in my own family that I can't talk politics with. So I must have an all-American family, right? And I guess most of us do. But when you think about it, these were all white, male, landed gentry. That's who we the people were at the time of the Constitutional Convention. So they were tribal. They looked alike. But under the surface, they differed with each other so dramatically that they had to create a system of government that allowed them to establish a country without resolving their differences. Mm. So what they created was a tension-holding system of government. They couldn't have gotten out of the room if they hadn't created a system of government that, for the first time in human history, treats conflict and tension not as the enemy of a good social order, but as the engine of a better social order, the engine of a more perfect union, to quote that great phrase from American history.
So how would you respond if you're sitting in a living room conversation and somebody who's from a more conservative political viewpoint says, well, I think, you know, the government is the root of all of our problems? That's not what you, as co-founder of Move On, would think. How do you deal with that?
I listen and I think about why they believe that. And there's generally some truth to what they have to say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm thinking, Joan and Anne, about a conversation I had maybe a year ago with a physician who was complaining about big government. And what I did was say, well, tell me a story that will help me understand what you mean. And so he told me a story about the recent weeks of his life, where night after night after night, after an exhausting day of treating patients with serious problems, he had to fill out forms, bureaucratic forms. And as he described them, I began to see how really unessential these forms were and how they had probably been generated by bureaucrats who earned their living by generating forms. And they were killing my friend, and they were depriving him of family time, and they were wearing him down to the point where the next day he might well be unable to treat his patients as patiently and as kindly as he would like to do. So it's an illustration of what Joan is saying, that the you know, there's an old saying that the more you know about another person's story, the less possible it is to dislike, distrust, or dismiss them. And I think that's a simple truth.
Well, I want to ask about, at a much more personal level, it seems to me that one of the things you're talking about is the amount of fear that we all carry inside ourselves. I mean, when you reference the news media, for instance, you pick up the newspaper, you know, in the morning, and by the time you finished your morning breakfast, you've been reminded that you feel under attack and fearful. So it seems to me that one of the things you're talking about, I mean, that one of the advantages just at a personal level is breaking down that feeling of fear and learning to feel just a greater sense of trust that we're all nice people.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, I mean, you know, we're all mixed bag, right?
Yeah. I kind of lost it with nice people.
but I'm with you on that. So the other thing I think, Anne, that is associated with the fear that you importantly point to is a sense of disempowerment.
Yeah.
That's closely linked with fear. So when all of my information is about them and it's portrayed at 120 miles an hour in these big picture images that are interrupted every 90 seconds by commercials, no story gone into in any depth, the world is presented at such speed, such magnitude, that an ordinary mortal like me can't possibly keep up with it. It's fear, it's disempowerment, and it deepens my own tendency toward privatizing my life.
Sure, bunker mentality.
Exactly. Triple lock the door, pop onto Netflix, and spend your time that way.
Well, we're living at a time when it feels like there's so much at stake also. I mean, I do think that the global problem of climate change kind of underscores all of this. There is a very real sense of threat. Joan, you were going to say something. Sorry.
And it's actually related to that. The core of the reason for living room conversations for me is climate change, because if the world as we now know it is going to be damaged to the point that it can't support future generations, that's an emergency right now. Our ability to work collaboratively is crucial. So I honestly don't care what people choose to talk about, and I'm starting to think the best initial conversations are actually about crony capitalism or something where there's a lot of shared common ground, because building that relationship where you care about each other and you realize you have so much in common is the most important thing at this point.
Joan Blades is the co-founder of MoveOn.org and founder of Living Room Conversations. Parker Palmer is the founder and senior partner of the Center for Courage and Renewal. His book, Healing the Heart of Democracy, is just out in paper. You'll find more information about both on our website, ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison, Wisconsin. Stephanie Youngblood produced this hour with help from Doug Gordon, Sarah Nix, Charles Monroe Kane, and Will Henkes. Steve Mullen from Walk West Music composed our theme music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for spending time with us today.
PRI, Public Radio International.